over here to Paris from the sunny southern shore. I to Monte Carlo went just to raise me with the rent. Dame Fortune smiled upon me as she never smiled before, and I've now got lots of money, I'm a gent. Yes, I've now got lots of rhino, I'm a gent. As I walk along the Bois Boulogne with an independent air, you can hear the girls declare, he must be a millionaire. You can hear them sigh and wink, and I will see them wink the other eye at the man who broke the bank at Monte Carlo. As I walk along the Bois Boulogne with an independent air, you can hear the girls declare, he must be a millionaire. You can hear them sigh and wink, and I will see them wink the other eye at the man who broke the bank at Monte Carlo. I stay indoors till after lunch, and then me daily walk to the great triumphal arch. He's one grand triumphal march. A fair white observer with the keenness of a hawk. I'm a mass of money, linen, silk and starch. I'm a mass of money, linen, silk and starch. Anybody see my voice is carefully trained for the choir. As I walk along the Bois Boulogne with an independent air, you can hear the girls declare, he must be a millionaire. You can hear them sigh and wish that I will see them wink the other eye at the man who broke the bank at Monte Carlo. As I walk along the Bois Boulogne with an independent air, you can hear the girls declare, he must be a millionaire. You can hear them sigh and wish that I will see them wink the other eye at the man who broke the bank at Monte Carlo. I patronized the tables at the Monte Carlo Hill till they hadn't got a shoe for the Christian or a Jew. I then flew off to Paris for the charms of Mademoiselle, who's the darling of my heart, what can I do? When with 20 tongues she swears that she's through. Now, I think we'll have a variety. I'll sing you this chorus in the French language. Quand je balade au Bois Boulogne et le long des grands boulevards, je m'attire tous les regards, on crie chez lui le blanc. Je n'ai pas une ni plante, ni brun, ni droite, pas d'un bon de fortune, qui finit tout et la banque à Monte Carlo. Oh, les gars, as I walk along the Bois Boulogne with an independent air, could hear the girls declare, he must be a millionaire. Could hear them sigh and wink, and I will see them wink the other eye at the man who broke the bank at Monte Carlo.
Welcome to another edition of Critical Thinking on WFMT. I'm Matt DeStefano. We open our program with Charles Coburn there singing the Fred Gilbert composition, The Man Who Broke the Bank at Monte Carlo, setting the backdrop for our conversation with Brian Dennehy, winner of 2 Tony Awards for Best Lead Actor in a Play, for projects that originated at Chicago's Goodman Theater. We take you now to a lounge inside the Goodman Theater, somewhat near a window and complete with street ambience and the sounds of an occasional L train passing by, for a conversation with Andrew Patner and our guest tonight on Critical Thinking, Brian Dennehy.
The temptation in talking with Brian Dennehy, which it is a great pleasure to at last be doing, he's been coming to Chicago to make theater now for 25 years, which is half a lifetime for at least one of us in this conversation and a good portion of a lifetime for the other.
I started when I was 12.
The temptation is to just let Brian Dennehy tell stories, particularly because he's playing 2 great storytellers, Huey and Crap. We should say that's K-R-A-P-P, in an extraordinary double bill at the Goodman Theater. He has over the years, well, we'll go through some of those years. He's done it all, at least 5 O'Neills, 1 Brecht, 1 Arthur Miller, and 1 we're going to talk about that was before that, right?
Yeah, I guess. I can't keep track of it. We started with Galileo. We started with Brecht.
But before that, there was a play that Bob Falls from the Goodman now, then from a little company on the north side called Wisdom Bridge, right on the border with Evanston, actually saw you in a play on the East Coast, in D.C., maybe.
He was the artistic director of Wisdom Bridge, which is a small theater in Rogers Park, which no longer exists, sadly. And a friend of his, Steve Robman, and I had seen a production of this play in New York, which had been brought in complete from London. Brian Cox starred in Ron Hutchinson's great play about the Irish Troubles called Rat in the Skull, wonderful image. And I loved it, of course, and wanted to do it. And Bob hired Steve and me to go up to Rogers Park and do the play. And it was my first exposure actually working in Chicago, not in film. And I had a great time. The show was a big success critically. It's hard to make any kind of success financially in any of those little theaters. But that was the beginning. And when Bob moved to the Goodman a few years later, our relationship started with Galileo, major production of Galileo, and it's been going ever since. And we've done a lot of stuff.
Galileo, where was the chicken and where was the egg on that? Was this something Bob had been wanting to do? Was this something?
Well, the funny thing is, the Goodman was in those days at the Art Institute, and it was a long-standing Chicago theater, which was in very serious financial trouble. Regional theaters are always in trouble, one kind or another. Bob took over for Mosher. What's his first name?
Greg Mosher.
Very good producer, pretty good director. In fact, he's got a hit on Broadway right now in View from the Bridge. And, you know, there was a financial problem, as there always is. So when Bob appeared before the committee trying to find someone to take over the job, contrary to what all the other candidates had said, well, we'll do a couple of small character plays. We'll try to build up the finances. Bob says, I'm going to do the biggest, most expensive production I can find. What I'm going to do is do real theater. And sure enough, his first production was Galileo, which was enormous. I mean, I don't know. We had 30 or 40 people in the cast. We had 13 or 14 set piece scenes, which were extremely complicated because his vision, beautifully, was to take the example of Galileo, which was 15th century or 16th century Italian astronomer, and using the character through his travails with the church, move it through the centuries so that the final images are Galileo or Brecht being trapped inside either East Germany or America, depending upon your point of view politically. Very complicated show in a theater with limited wing space and absolutely no fly space. Mm-hmm. Well, we did it, and it was a big success.
It was remarkable. I can still, 24 years ago, I still have the images of that
play. We had
projection
images on the ceiling.
Right.
We had singers singing some of Brecht's little compositions that he had written over the years, having nothing whatever to do with the play. In any case.
You had a guy named Frank Galati.
And Frank Galati was playing the Pope. Quite appropriately,
Pope, right?
And had to kiss his ring every night, but it was a lot of fun, and that was the beginning at the Goodman of what became a very special relationship over the years.
So. How does it work for somebody who is as busy as you've been in television and film? Do you just set aside blocks of time and say, I know those big money offers to play Sergeant So-and-so on episode 82 of such and such series are flooding in, but clear my calendar because I'm going to be doing Death of a Salesman for 2 years?
Believe me, my calendar is very clear these days, okay? And when you get to be 71 years old, television, as far as television is concerned, you were buried 30 years ago. Somebody came up to me in the airport a few weeks ago and said, didn't you used to be Brian Dennehy? And I said, yeah, I used to be. So, you know, that's always, well, typically for most people, is a pretty short life, 10, 12, 15 years. Until what happens, and inevitably, it didn't used to be this way. I mean, we were talking before about Walter Matthau. I worked with Lee Marvin. Those guys had 30 or 40 year careers because, of course, the guys who ran the studios were always around. But now what happens is people who run the network, run the studios, they're all 24. When they get to be 26, they get thrown out and they get another set of 24 years. And they don't know who you are, nor do they care, nor should they. Right. They find somebody else and somebody else comes
in. It's
just
a different set. It's not that something's, quote, better or worse. It's a different set of circumstances.
That's just fashion. Yeah. You know, we are trapped in this squirrel cage of fashion these days. So that the fashion wheel just spins faster and faster and faster and faster. And the current craze, which will last for a little while, you know, are absolutely undernourished 17-year-old vampire types.
Right.
You know, if you look like a vampire, you could be a vampire, you know, and or we can stick teeth in there and, you know, have some, that's perfect. So if you're a vampire, and I'll tell you one thing, I don't pass for a vampire under any circumstances, unless there was a really old fat vampire, and somehow that doesn't work. So
in a way, you were prescient. 25 years ago, you obviously saw this would be happening, and you figured, right. You know, I might as well do a lot of big, heavy, long, long-running,
well,
three-hour shows.
The funny thing is, nobody ever gets paid, you know, in regional theater. I mean, you get some money, but it's not very much. But the joke is now, of course, I'm doing regional theater for the money. So, but, now, you know, this is a great town. Chicago is my adoptive city. Chicago reminds me of the way New York was when I was a kid growing up in the 50s, where we didn't realize it at the time, but it was this incredible banquet. And Chicago for the last 25 years for me has been the same. It's obviously different now than it was in those years when you always had O'Rourke's, whatever you...
You were going to buy O'Rourke's.
No, I didn't buy O'Rourke's.
Actually, was that a rumor? No.
I would not. First of all, you couldn't buy O'Rourke's. I don't care how much money you had. You couldn't buy it. O'Rourke's was a place, like any great places, that existed in and of itself, and because of its owner, the guy who ran the place, Jay Kovar. It had the most amazing and unique character that couldn't be transferred to another person.
It was a small bar in a Chicago Fire era wood frame, 1.5-story house on
North Avenue.
On North Avenue.
And then it moved to Halsted. I helped him move to Halsted and lent him some money, gave him some money, whatever the deal was. I remember 2 or 3 years later, my accountant calling me up and saying, "Who is this Jay Kovar?" I said, "Oh, he's a guy, he's a friend of mine in Chicago." "Why?" She said, "Well, he's the only guy who's ever paid you back." With interest. And Jay, that's the kind of guy Jay was. Jay had a picture over the cash register of Lenny Bruce. You don't have to say much more about the place than that. He had full-length portraits along the walls of William Butler Yeats, Sean O'Casey, Oscar Wilde, and James Joyce. Mm-hmm. And that pretty, and the best jukebox that ever existed in the world. I mean, Count Basie, whom that is not. just the most amazing atmosphere. It was a writer's atmosphere.
Yeah. Writer's atmosphere, jukebox, portraits of these great Irish writers and loquators. These are not things that make nightlife today.
And also, he refused, this is what I loved about him, he refused to have a wine list. If anybody came in and asked for a wine list, he was not the kind of customer that Jay wanted. He would say, "Go down the street. We don't serve it here." He had these little bottles of the worst wine you ever had in your life. So you could say, "I'll take one of the red bottles or I'll take one of the white bottles." But there was no label to speak of, and God only knows what year it was. But it was just a special place, which characterized for me the whole experience of being here. That was, Steppenwolf was just beginning to get their legs and they were doing wonderful stuff. And I got to know people like Billy Peterson and special, very special actors and actresses, Kate Buttigieg and Howard Witt. And I mean, we had a cast in Iceman Cometh of some extraordinary characters. Mm-hmm. it was just a wonderful, wonderful place to be.
Yeah.
And to be able to do theater at the same time and have some fun. And I mean, Chicago's always been the great American city. Still is. It certainly was then. So it's always fun to come back, even though I am a lot older and I live a much different life.
Was it a reminder for you of what it was you had been wanting to do, or was it a discovery that you wanted to spend this much time again with theater?
Well, you know, I became an actor under very peculiar circumstances. Most guys my age never went to acting school. We didn't become actors because we went to Brandeis or Northwestern. It kind of fell into it. I got out of the Marine Corps in 1963, and I had a wife and a couple of kids, and I had graduated from Columbia.
Columbia University in New York.
In New York, yeah, Columbia College. I didn't know what the hell I was looking to do. My father wanted me to go to law school, came from a kind of a blue-collar Irish-American family. I had a wonderful teacher in high school who had a small little theater group, and I did some theater in high school, but I hadn't done any in college or even at all subsequent to that. Anyway, one thing led to another. I was doing off-Broadway plays, and Mel Gussow, mm-hmm. who used to be the second chair critic for the New York Times, saw me in a play, gave me a great review. And in those days, that made a difference.
Yeah.
And that's how it all started. But even from the beginning, I was not looking to do a TV series. I wasn't even looking to be in the movies. I just wanted to do this, what it is that I'm doing now, mm-hmm. some 50 years later, 40 years later, doing some interesting stuff on stage, stuff which is interesting to me mm-hmm. and interesting to Bob. Two great playwrights, one American, Irish-American, one Irish, who spent his life living in Paris, writing, both at exactly the same age. Mm-hmm. They were both 52, 53 years old, having won Nobel Prizes, both of them.
Right.
Now they have all the money they're ever going to be able to spend. They're successful playwrights. And they write these plays, both plays dealing with who they were and who they became. And more importantly, dealing with observed lives. In O'Neill's case, his brother's life, which he observed over and over and over again. And in Beckett's life, his own life. Mm-hmm. Those stories that he tells us, his younger self tells on the tape recorder about the experiences of his mother's death and the events on the pier, all happened to Beckett. And it's fascinating for me at my age, which is 71, to have the opportunity to do these two plays, which are these two extraordinary playwrights, both with very strong Irish ties, as I have, trying to understand their lives. Because we're all, three of us are trying to do the same thing.
They're also trying, aren't they, to understand their work, because they're sort of writing capsule versions of works that they were writing before and after.
Work, I think, also their philosophy. Mm-hmm. I mean, the real important thing about the plays is that in 45 minutes or 50 minutes, O'Neill describes in a very, very distilled and clear way his concept of the importance of delusion, illusion in life. To O'Neill, you wake up in the morning and you put on the character you have so carefully devised for yourself, like you put on your pants. Mm-hmm. And you wear it because that's what's important to you, the personality, the person that you have constructed, which is constructed and is to some extent at least, hiding from the reality, hiding from the world, hiding from the painful truth that may exist. Beckett's attitude was, what happens at the end of Huey, the O'Neill play, is that there is this little ray of sunshine that peeks through this gloomy concept of self-delusion, because our hero, Erie, finds someone else who may possibly participate in this act of delusion. Beckett will have none of that. Beckett's attitude is, the whole concept of life is a joke. It's not only a philosophical joke, it's a slapstick joke. It's the banana peel joke. Mm-hmm. Most basic slapstick joke of all. Man sees a banana, decides he wants to enjoy the fruit that exists inside the banana peel, peels the banana, but he drops the peel on the floor. He enjoys the banana, and then ultimately, and the audience, of course, knows this, ultimately he slips on the banana peel and he breaks his ass. And for Beckett, that's life. Mm-hmm. It doesn't make any difference how enthusiastically you enjoy your banana and how successful you are at consuming your banana. You go in the hole with everybody else. It's maybe not the funniest joke in the world, but it is, of course, humorous. All pretension, all vanity, ultimately, is humorous. And that's his basic point, the point that he made over and over and over again. Both writers did the same thing. They wrote essentially the same philosophy. Well, in 2 hours, if you're so inclined to immerse yourself in this, you can hear these great writers' voices. And for me, that's, you know, it's a privilege to be able to do that, along with Joe Grafasi, a wonderful actor from New York who's been friend of mine for 30 years, who was brilliant in a important but small part, and Bob Falls, who directed The Huey, which is always an ongoing process, and then Jennifer Tarver, this young woman from Toronto, who I'm absolutely crazy about. She and I worked together on The Beckett, but so it's been, it's a nice way to be 71, if there is such a thing as a nice way.
They call you Lady Luck, but there is room for doubt. At times you have a very unladylike way of running out. You're on a date with me, the pickings have been lush, and yet before this evening is over you might give me the brush. You might forget your manners, you might refuse to stay, and so the best that I can do is pray. Luck be a lady tonight. Luck be a lady tonight. Luck, if you've ever been a lady to begin with, luck be a lady tonight. Luck, let a gentleman see how nice a dame you can be. I know the way you've treated other guys you've been with. Luck be a lady with me. A lady doesn't leave her escort. It isn't fair, it isn't nice. A lady doesn't wander all over the room and blow on some other guy's dice. So let's keep the party polite. Never get out of my sight. Stick with me, baby, I'm the fella you came in with. Luck be a lady. Luck be a lady. Luck be a lady tonight.
Luck be a lady tonight. Luck be a lady tonight. Luck, if you've ever been a lady to begin with, luck be a lady tonight.
Luck, let a gentleman see,
luck, let a gentleman see
how nice a dame you can be. I know the way you've treated other guys you've been with. Luck be a lady with me. A lady wouldn't flirt with strangers. She'd have a heart, she'd have a soul.
A lady wouldn't make little snake eyes at me when I've bet my life on this roll. So let's keep the party polite.
So let's keep the party polite.
Never get out of my sight.
Never get out of my sight.
Stick with me, baby. I'm the fella you came in with. Luck be a lady.
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 What's the matter? Roll the dice. Roll
now.
Blue eyes, brown eyes, whatever, whomever, Luck Be a Lady is a great song, and Robert Alda performed it there, Luck Be a Lady from Guys and Dolls, written by Frank Lesser. You're tuned to 98.7 WFMT in Chicago, and streaming at WFMT.com. Also, at WFMT.com/critical thinking, that's where you can find our podcast, the free Critical Thinking podcast, featuring the Critical Thinking Archives. If you'd like to hear this edition again or previous editions, that's the way to do so, or you can search WFMT Critical Thinking in iTunes. We return you now to the Goodman Theater for the conclusion of tonight's conversation. Andrew Pattner and our guest, actor Brian Dennehy.
How does it work when one is doing a double bill with two different directors?
Well, you obviously work on it differently. I mean, the Huey has been a work in progress. That's been going on now for 4 or 5 years.
Right.
But, you know, like any great play, it's always different. I'm actually going to go back to Long Day's Journey, I think, in the fall with Vanessa in London. And that'll be interesting to return to that with a different director and probably different actors. But a great part is never done. You know, that's one of the things I love about the British theater. You know, Gielgud did Hamlet 5 times. I think the last time he was 47 years old. And apparently one of his best performances. And I see no reason if you are vaguely appropriate for the age, which I am not, by the way, for the Yuri, but we kind of make a joke out of that anyway. It's just really interesting to keep going back and seeing what else exists. I mean, I was at a cocktail party in Los Angeles once, and Ashkenazi, the great pianist, was there. And we were talking about this subject because I said to him, how many times have you played the concerto in D? And he thought for a minute. He said, probably 10,000 times. I said, well, I'm going to ask you a question that everybody always asks me.
Yeah.
How do you do it over and over and over again and make it fresh? He said, but you're not doing it over and over again. Every time you do it for the first time. He said, because now, he said, the words in music, and this is true for the Huey, for example, for me, the words in music are part of me now, after 300 or 400 performances. But now what you do is you go out on stage, and whatever happened to you that day, wherever you are, psychologically, emotionally, however you feel, becomes a part of the performance, as it should. And the audience is always different.
Right.
So every time you do it, it is different. Same thing with Salesman, which I did 650 times. You don't try to do the same performance. It would be stupid to do the same performance. Mm-hmm. Every performance is different. Now, of course, they have to be great parts. You can't do that with a stupid part. I mean, because there's just no possibility there. But with these parts.
So in a way, having the two, not only the two works, but the two different directors and those perspectives that they worked out with you, the two of them then sort of play off of each other in terms of the way that you're becoming each of them in the course of an evening.
Yeah, I think the point really was to try to say to the audience, okay, here are two authors with very, very different backgrounds, although the Irishness is definitely a part of both of them, looking at the same subject. Do you get that? Do you understand that? Do you see what they're doing and how they're doing it? Does it make any difference to you? Aside from the fact that you're hearing and you're experiencing the two plays in and of themselves, and they are sui generis, they exist by themselves, and they're important by themselves, they're also, it's like a prism. You're seeing rays of light directing at the same object and being refracted in different ways and illuminating different parts of existence. Now, having said that, they're also kind of entertaining. One guy, Erie, is a storyteller, and he's pretty funny and amusing. There are tragic elements to him, which have ultimately come out. And he is annoying in many ways, but it's an O'Neill character. The crap, of course, is a mystery. It's a whole mystery. It moves from this really obvious slapstick joke into this terribly tragic and at the same time amusing mm-hmm. dilemma that this guy has. Mm-hmm. He looks back at his younger self and says, I allowed that person, and a lot of us do this, to destroy my life by his pretensions and by his assumptions about life that were not. There were a few moments of joy in my life, and I grabbed them and I let them go. And even though it sounds very gloomy, they're very illuminating and very amusing plays. Mm-hmm. Those plays were written in the 50s, 40s and 50s. I've been thinking about this a lot lately. Miller's play, Salesman, was written in the 40s. Chekhov was written turn of the last century. Strindberg, Ibsen. People who are thinking about life and what it means and what the point is and so forth. And through the 20s and through the 30s and the 40s and 50s, up into the 60s, and to some extent now, but not very much. People were trying, you know, the audiences were trying to get some answers. What the hell is this all about? Why are we doing this? What's different now is you don't have to do that. You can take a pill now. Mm-hmm. You don't have to be worried about what is the significance of my life? Am I doing anything important? Because if you feel really bad, you get to take a mood elevator. Just turn those serotonins loose and you'll feel better. Mm-hmm. I think the audiences are different now. Mm. They're not as, for the most, not all of them, obviously. Some people really are. But there is a whole different attitude now in audiences, which is...
Even among those people who choose to go to live theater.
People who come to theater. I'm talking about the ones who come. Right, obviously, right. The ones who don't come, I don't know anything about them. But the ones who come, it's like... It's a certain connection, but I can remember 30 or 40 years ago when an audience responded to a play, the response was powerful, and you could feel, you know, every once in a while it happens now, but not the way it used to.
Right. If there would be a play in town, either put on here or had come through here, or maybe a little bit of both, such as at the Goodman, and you'd feel it throughout town, not yeah. just if you went there, people would say, have you seen it yet? You know, this kind of.
I was talking to a guy who was a psychiatrist a couple of weeks ago. And I said, what do you do these days? Who's in analysis?
What
insurance
did he
companies
say?
Won't pay for it. You know, he's just, I write prescriptions.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the theater used to kind of provide something like that. You know, it used to provide something where people, you know, for example, when Salesman was done in 1949. It was like this catharsis. You know, the first performance in Philadelphia and the first performance mm-hmm. in New York, it was like this explosion of understanding.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure that happens anymore. In theater.
Yeah,
I
right.
don't, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, our example would be Avatar. Well, Avatar, yeah, it's beautifully done, and it's tremendous technology, and it's an interesting story, but I'm not talking about that.
Sure, but I mean, when Beckett was first being produced, he was up against The Country Girl, and, you know, there was just stuff
his stuff was... Beckett was a writer. First of all, he wanted to be a fiction writer.
Right.
He wrote books.
Right.
And they were usually very well critically received, but nobody bought them.
Right.
And, of course, he spent his early part of his life living and serving Joyce, mm-hmm. which had to be some kind of self-inflicted pain, because here you are with recognizably the greatest writer in English, you know,
ever,
of any century.
Maybe,
yeah.
Right.
And here you are saying, well, I want to be a writer, too. Jesus, man, you know, it's like setting yourself next to Mount Everest. But eventually... he discovered a whole new voice. And the funny thing is that I think some of this play has to do with that. The fact that He gets it. He gets the Nobel. He gets the money. He gets the girls. He lives in Paris. He's lionized, surrounded by PhD candidates and photographers. And you can hear, you can feel his amusement with it all through the writing. Too late. Too late. Mm-hmm. Would have been better 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. O'Neill got it when he was young. But it wasn't enough for him because he knew he wasn't telling the truth that he had to tell. It wasn't really until he was in his 50s that he began to tell that truth, which ultimately became Long Day's Journey. Because those scars that were on his soul, he had to keep ripping open and looking at over and over and over again. The Beckett's observations were much more abstract and cold and funny, but a different kind of funny.
But the truth-telling still goes on. I mean, maybe you are connecting to X percent fewer people than you might have been before, but you're still hitting it with somebody in that audience every night.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you get letters from people, and you can feel it. You know, you can feel it from certain members of the audience that maybe aren't taking the pills.
Right.
And who need the kind of, I don't want to call it therapy. It's not therapeutic. It's an attempt to understand. I mean, both plays are attempts by two of the world's great artists. Attempts to understand what happened. Well, that's worth doing.
Yeah.
And that's worth listening to.
You used the word earlier, illuminating, and that means that there's something that comes out of them. And the fact that here you are 10, 20 years older than these two characters and playing them is kind of a refutation of the idea that it's a terminus that they're talking
about.
Yeah,
well, of course, the question I always ask is, if I don't do it, who will?
Mm-hmm.
It needs to be done. The opportunity to hear it has to be presented. Whether anybody goes or listens or enjoys or gets it, I can't control that.
Yeah.
But what I can control is, let's do it. Let's present it. Let's create the environment where if there are people out there who really want to explore these ideas and to listen to them and to try to understand what these great artists were saying, then let's do our part,
right,
which is to present it.
I was concerned, you say, let's hear it. I was concerned initially that these were being mounted in the large theater here, because having seen Huey in the smaller theater, having seen
I was concerned too. That's why it was
the tiny old Goodman Studio crap. Yet there is this focus, this attention, and some of that has to come from your making a demand on us that we hear you.
Well, the funny thing is, we had ambitions to move it to New York. I don't know what's going to happen with that. We still may very well take it on tour. I would like to take it on tour because, and believe me, I'm not crazy about touring. But I think at 71, shortly to be 72, I can't think of a better way than to spend these years than presenting these two pieces of thought and
action. It does more as a tour in many ways, doesn't it?
Yes, it
than
does.
It does whether or not you deal with the vagaries.
Because you go to Minneapolis, you go to Cincinnati, you go to San Francisco, you go to Los Angeles, and there are certain people who are going to seek you out, and they're going to want to hear these voices, and you want to connect with those people. Now, it would be nice to film this stuff, but it's not the same on film. It can never be the same on film. One of the things that scares me about the theater and whatever's happening to it, and I'm not sure what is happening to it, and I don't want to make any conclusions, what happens in the theater can only happen in the theater. I don't give a damn how good the movie is or how good the performance is. You are protected from the performance by a machine and by God knows how many layers of activity going on, editing and so on and so forth. What happens in the theater only happens in the theater. Mm-hmm. And if it's the work of Sam Beckett, critical, crucial, to the point work, if it's the work of Eugene O'Neill, who never said anything in 45 minutes that he could say in 4 hours, then it's worth hearing and seeing live on stage.
I'm sure you know the story Bert Lahr would tell, that you're doing the show for the guy who comes in from out of the rain who wasn't even planning to go to the theater. Supposedly a guy comes to see him and says, you know, my wife tossed me out. I'm walking down the street. It's pouring rain. I go inside. You're doing the show. It's me.
Yeah.
And Lahr said that, you know, when he was asked the how do you do it night after night questions, you do it for the guy who comes in from out of the rain. Because that's, and that guy in Cincinnati or that woman in Minneapolis is the reason you're doing this.
I mean, the thing about O'Neill and Beckett is that so many people mistakenly feel that that has nothing to do with me. Mm-hmm. Gossip Girl has more to do with me. Desperate Wives has more to do with me. And that's not true. These guys are great artists and women, same thing. And they understand. They're trying to understand what it is to be you. I mean, the thing about Erie is the lowest form of life in New York City. He's a grifter. He's a hustler. Mm-hmm.
And he's a two-bit hustler, too.
Yeah, he's learned to hang on by his fingernails. Yeah. At the same time, his life is amusing. He's learned that by telling stories, he can make himself a few bucks. He can maybe get a couple of drinks from somebody and grab a meal. And O'Neill understood that. O'Neill's brother was that guy, Jamie. And God knows there's no great separation between the people sitting in the audience, and let's say their fathers or their grandfathers or their uncles, and this poor old man sitting on stage at his desk in his terrible apartment north of the Liffey in Dublin. We're all those people. Those people are us, and we are them, and what happens to them is all part of our experience. The whole ball game is trying to understand it. Regardless of the pill, it doesn't hurt to try to understand it.
Well, Brian Dennehy, thank you for helping us at least try to understand, and thanks for telling your stories both on the stage at the Goodman and here on the radio with us.
Thanks. I appreciate it.
Träume kehret wieder. Alle Träume kehret
The great American lyric tenor Roland Hayes singing Franz Schubert's Nacht und Träume, a favorite song of playwright Samuel Beckett. Before that, two pieces set to the words of Samuel Beckett. We heard from Morton Feldman's Neither, an opera, Neither No. 4, performed by Kwame Ryan, Petra Hoffman, and the Symphonieorchester des Bayerischen Rundfunks. Before that, from Earl Kim's four-part cycle, Exercises in Root, we heard number 3, Gooseberries, She Said, performed by Benita Valenta and the Metamorphosis Chamber Ensemble and Scott Yu. That'll do it for this edition of Critical Thinking. We'd like to thank our funders, Elphawood Foundation, the Kovler Family Foundation, and other friends of Critical Thinking. We'd also like to thank David Polk for engineering this interview in a pinch, and on location. Thank you, David. We'd like to hear what you thought of this program. Drop us a line at rentap, Patner spelled backwards, R-E-N-T-A-P, at AOL.com. And don't forget to check out the Critical Thinking podcast. And you can get that at WFMT.com/Critical Thinking. It's always free, and it features the Critical Thinking archives. So for Andrew Patner, I am Matt DeStefano. We'll catch you next week.